Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.
Richard Milhouse Nixon, 37th President of the United States, thus became the first to resign from office. It was the climax to a frequently triumphant, often turbulent, usant, often turbulent, usant, often turbulent, usant, often turbulent, usually controversial political career. Elected to the House of Representatives from California in 1946, he was described as a ruthless opponent. Elected to the Senate in 1950, he was accused of unfair campaign practices. In Congress, he pressed the case against Alger Hiss, accused of having passed government information to Russian agents in the 1930s. Hiss went to prison, and Nixon was a national figure. In 1952, Nixon was nominated for vice president on the ticket headed by General Dwight Eisenhower. The campaign had hardly begun when it was disclaimed, with demands mounting that Ike dump him, Nixon took to the airwaves.
I should say this, that Pat doesn't have a mink coat, but she does have a respectable Republican cloth coat. And I always tell her that she'd look good in anything. We did get something, a gift, after the election. A man down in Texas heard Pat in the radio mention the fact that our two youngsters would like to have a dog. And believe it or not, the day before we left on this campaign trip, we got a message from the Union Station in Baltimore saying they had a package for us. We went down to get it. You know what it was? It was a little Cocker Spaniel dog in a crate that he'd sent all the way from Texas. Black and white, spotted. And our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checkers. And you know, the kids, like all kids, love the dog. And I just want to say this right now, that regardless of what they say about it, we're going to keep him.
Ike was satisfied.
I have never seen any come through in better fashion than Senator Nixon did tonight.
As Ike's emissary, Nixon visited 56 nations. In Moscow, he took on Premier Khrushchev in the famous kitchen debate, so-called because it took place in a model of an American kitchen.
I can say that we had some differences with Chairman Khrushchev and on the points at issue. I would say that it was not a case of his convincing me or of my convincing him, but there was one point on which we did agree, and that is that the differences between nations in today's world must be settled at the conference table and not on the battlefield.
In Venezuela, anti-American demonstrators smashed the windows of Nixon's car.
I have never taken a trip yet in which I have not been warned that there would be demonstrations. I have never taken a trip yet in which I have not had at least some warnings that somebody was going to try to kill me or members of my party. And I can only say that if we allow what I would call bullies to keep the officials of the government of the United States from doing what we think needs to be done to carry out our foreign policy, then we'd better get off the face of the earth.
When Ike suffered a heart attack, Nixon presided over meetings of the Cabinet and National Security Council. No vice president was ever better groomed for the presidency. Nominated in 1960, his opponent John F. Kennedy challenged him to a series of broadcast debates. Nixon agreed. Kennedy won the debates and the election. In 1962, Nixon attempted to regain political stature by running for governor of California. He suffered a whopping defeat.
But as I leave you, I want you to know, just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore. Because, gentlemen, this is my last press conference.
Nixon returned east, set up a lucrative law practice in New York, and began mending his political fences. In 1968, he made another try for the presidency. He won the nomination and the election. 1972 was a year of great personal triumphs for Nixon. He went to Peking and reestablished contact with mainland China. He went to Moscow and returned with an arms limitation agreement. He brought about an end to the war in Vietnam. And he won re-election by the largest popular vote margin in American history. Then Watergate surfaced. In June 1972, before the election, six bumbling burglars were caught in the offices of the Democratic National Committee. Two of them were officials of the committee to re-elect the president, G. Gordon Liddy and James McCord. Another was a White House consultant, E. Howard Hunt. Within hours, a cover-up was underway to prevent disclosure of the connection between the burglars and the committee. But in mid-1973, McCord talked. So did John Dean 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 talked. So did John Dean, who had... One by one, others were implicated, including the highest White House aides. Nixon broadcast frequent denials of any personal involvement and ridiculed suggestions that he resign. In March 1974, he addressed business executives in Chicago.
Resignation is an easy cop-out. Resignation, of course, might satisfy some of my good, friendly partisans who would rather not have the problem of Watergate bothering them. But, on the other hand, apart from the personal standpoint, resignation of this president on charges of which he is not guilty, resignation simply because he happened to be low in the polls, would forever change our form of government. It would lead to weak and unstable presidencies in the future, and I will not be a party to the destruction of the presidency of the United States.
The most incriminating evidence against those implicated in Watergate and the cover-up came from tapes of presidential conversations. Nixon fought a constant battle with Special Prosecutor Leon Jaworski, with the Congress, and with the courts to keep some of the tape secret. Meanwhile, other factors added fuel to arguments that Nixon resign. His administration was accused of using government agencies to hound White House enemies. Political aides admitted so-called dirty tricks in the 1972 campaign. Businesses and corporations pleaded guilty to making illegal donations to the campaign. Nixon himself ran into tax problems. Congressional investigators and the Internal Revenue Service concluded he had underpaid his taxes by some $432,000. Nixon said he would pay. After investigating all allegations against the president, the House Judiciary Committee met publicly to debate possible impeachment. Michigan Democrat John Conyers.
The president took the power of his office and under the guise of protecting and executing the laws that he swore to uphold, he abused them. In so doing, he has jeopardized the strength and integrity of the Constitution and laws of the land and the protections that they ought to afford all they ought to afford, 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 all they ought to afford.
But he must be impeached and convicted by the Senate if we are to remain a free, courageous, and independent people.
Republican David Dennis of Indiana argued there was no convincing case against the president.
There will be another election. In 1976, and we could enter our 200th year. Better by preserving our rights until that time, and not trying to purge our sins by the persecution of an imperfect president who probably. Represents us both in his strength and his weakness, 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 all strength and his weakness, all strength and his weakness, all to
engaging in a course of conduct designed to obstruct justice in the Watergate case. All 21 Democrats and 6 Republicans voted for the article, making the tally 27 to 11. The second article accused the president of failing repeatedly to carry out his constitutional oath and duty to uphold the nation's laws. It passed 28 to 10. The third article charged defiance. The third article charged defiance. The third article charged defiance. The third article charged defiance of committee subpoenas. It was adopted 21-17. Meanwhile, on July 24th, the day the impeachment debate began, the Supreme Court handed down an historic decision. It ruled that the president must surrender tapes sought by Special Prosecutor Jaworski for use in the trial of five former White House aides. On August 5th, the White House released what lawyers called the smoking pistol. It was the transcript of a tape showing that 6 days after Watergate, Nixon ordered that the FBI be told not to go any further into the case. Nixon admitted he had kept this evidence even from his attorneys. Then the stone wall began to crumble. Nixon's support in Congress virtually vanished. Recognizing this, Nixon addressed the American people on August 8th.
To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. America needs a full-time president and a full-time Congress, particularly at this time with problems we face at home and abroad. To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the president and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office. 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 In this office.
Farewell to his staff.
Sure, we've done some things wrong in this administration. And the top man always takes the responsibility, and I've never ducked it. But I want to say one thing we can be proud of. 5.5 years. No man or no woman came into this administration and left it with more of this world's goods than when he came in. No man or no woman ever profited at the public expense or the public lickfall. That tells something about you. Mistakes, yes, but for personal gain, never. You did what you believed in. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong. And I only wish that I were a wealthy man. Healthy man. Present time, I've got to find a way to pay my taxes.
A helicopter carried Nixon and members of his family to Andrews Air Force Base, where they boarded the presidential jet. When his resignation became effective, Nixon was well on his way to California. Arriving in his native state, Nixon told a crowd of well-wishers, "We're home." This is Ed DeFontaine.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do solemnly swear.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability.
And will, to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Sworn in by Chief Justice Warren Burger, Gerald Ford became the first president not to be elected to either that office or the vice presidency. In his initial remarks as president, he did not forget the man who had tapped him for the vice presidency after the resignation of Spiro Agnew.
Before closing, I ask again your prayers for Richard Nixon and for his family. May our former president, who brought peace to millions, find it for himself.
Ford's elevation to the presidency met with warm approval on Capitol Hill, where he had spent 24 years as a member of the House. One of his first official acts was to address a joint session of Congress.
As Vice President, at the request of the President, I address myself to the individual. There will be no illegal tapping by my administration.
The main thrust of the new president's message was a matter of growing concern to nearly every American.
My first priority is to work with you to bring inflation under control. Inflation is domestic enemy number one. To restore economic confidence, the government in Washington must provide some leadership. It does no good to blame the public for spending too much when the government is spending too much.
Back in the White House, Ford turned his attention to a pressing problem, selection of a vice president.
He comes from a family that has long been associated with the building of a better America. It's a family that has contributed significantly to many accomplishments, both at home and abroad, for the American people. It is my honor and privilege to introduce to you a good partner for me, and I think a good partner for our country and the world. So I now announce officially that I will send the name of Nelson Rockefeller to the Congress of the United States for confirmation. Nelson?
You, Mr. President, through your dedication and your openness, have already reawakened faith and hope. And under your leadership, we as a people and we as a nation have the will, the determination, and the capability to overcome the hard realities of our times. I'm optimistic about the long-term future. Thank you, sir.
Even before he chose a vice president, Ford reversed a major policy decision of his predecessor. He said he favored leniency for the nation's 50,000 military draft evaders and deserters. He said such action would help bind up the nation's wounds. His statement was a prelude to another major decision. On Sunday, September 8th, the president attended early morning communion at St. John's Episcopal Church. Returning to the White House, he entered the Oval Room, where cameras and microphones had been set up.
I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, have granted, and by these presents do grant, a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon for all offenses against the United States which he, Richard Nixon, has committed or may have committed or taken part in during the period from July 20, 1969 through August 9, 1974.
In San Clemente, Nixon issued a statement accepting the pardon. The White House said no attempt had been made to get Nixon to acknowledge any wrongdoing and that the president made his announcement on the Sabbath to emphasize that the pardon was an act of mercy, not justice. First reaction to Ford's announcement came from his own news secretary, J.F. Terhorst, who announced his resignation with the comment, "Mercy, like justice, must also be even-handed." He referred to Nixon going free while five of his former aides were about to go on trial on criminal charges related to Watergate. Terhorst wasn't the only one to disagree with the president. Almost overnight, his personal popularity dropped 21 points in one national public opinion poll. There were protests in Congress, too. The adverse reaction apparently was more than Ford anticipated. To further explain his action, the president agreed to his action. 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 The president agreed to his action, the president agreed to appear before a subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee. First, the president read a prepared statement.
The purpose was to change our national focus. I wanted to do all I could to shift our attentions from the pursuit of a fallen president to the pursuit of the urgent needs of a rising nation.
For the most part, the committee members treated the president with deference, but there were pointed questions too. One came from Democratic Representative Don Edwards of California.
Mr. President, put yourself in the position of a high school teacher, shall we say, in Watts or the Barrios of San Jose or Harlem. And if you were such a teacher, how would you explain to the young people of America the American concept of equal justice under law?
Mr. Nixon was the 37th president of the United States. He had been preceded by 36 others. He is the only president in the history of this country who has resigned under shame and disgrace. I think that that in and of itself can be understood, can be explained to students or to others. That was a major, major step and a matter of, I'm sure, grave, grave deliberations by the former president. And it certainly, as I've said several times, constituted shame and disgrace.
Mr. President, do you think that it is wise to pardon a man before indictment or trial, for offenses that are completely unknown to you and which might possibly be terribly serious?
Well, as I indicated, Mr. Edwards, I did, to the best of my ability, check with probably the best authority in the country on what, if any, charges would be made against Mr. Nixon. I think that in taking the action I did concerning those charges, I was exercising in a proper way the pardon authority given a president under the Constitution.
Democrat Elizabeth Holtzman of New York raised a question that was on many minds.
I would like to point out, Mr. President, that the resolutions of inquiry which have prompted your appearance here today have resulted from very dark suspicions that have been created in the public's mind. Perhaps these suspicions are totally unfounded, and I sincerely hope that they are. But nonetheless, we must all confront the reality of these suspicions. And the suspicions that were created by the circumstances of the pardon which you issued, the secrecy with which it was issued, and the reasons for which it was issued, which made people question whether or not, in fact, there was a deal.
May I comment there? I want to assure you, the members of this subcommittee, the members of the Congress, and the American people, there was no deal, period. Under no circumstance.
When he issued the Nixon pardon, the president added to his prepared text a mention of concern for Nixon's health. 2 weeks after the pardon, Nixon entered a hospital. He was suffering from the phlebitis condition which first bothered him while he was still in the White House. He was treated and released. But he returned to the hospital in late October. This time, surgeons operated to combat a potentially lethal blood clot. Some hours later, hospital spokesman Norman Nager made this announcement.
At 12:45 p.m. today, former President Richard M. Nixon suddenly went into vascular shock. A team of physicians and intensive care nurses administered countershock measures for 3 hours until a stable vascular condition was once again restored.
For a time, Nixon's condition was listed as critical, and his news spokesman, Ron Ziegler, told reporters,
in talking to the doctors and to those who were with the president yesterday afternoon, there's no question about the fact that we almost lost President Nixon yesterday.
Ziegler rejected any idea that the former president was despondent.
I don't believe any report that suggests President Nixon has lost his will to live are accurate. He's a man of great strength and courage, and we'll pull out of this.
In mid-November, Nixon returned to his San Clemente home. Meanwhile, back east, Leon Jaworski resigned. In doing so, he reviewed his accomplishments as special prosecutor.
Two things we did that probably were without precedent. One of them was when we selected all of the evidence, got it sent by way of the grand jury to the House Judiciary Committee. They were able to build a case based on that. We had to go through the courts to get the courts to uphold our right to get it done. The other thing is, as you know, I argued the case in the United States Supreme Court that forced the former President Nixon to turn over the tapes. It was a sort of a forerunner to his resignation.
Elsewhere on the political scene, the nomination of Nelson Rockefeller as vice president was running into problems. After a series of news leaks, Rockefeller disclosed that he had, in one form or another, given $2 million to some 20 former and present public officials and staff aides. This was over a period of 17 years, most of which time he was governor of New York. His greatest single beneficiary was William Ronan, now chairman of the Port Authority of New York. He received $625,000. $86,000 went to L. Judson Morehouse, a former state Republican chairman who was later convicted of bribery. When Morehouse was sentenced to prison, Rockefeller commuted the sentence, giving ill health as the reason. Another Rockefeller beneficiary was Henry Kissinger, who received $50,000. At hearings before the Senate Rules Committee, Democrat Howard Cannon of Nevada told the nominee,
I am concerned about the large amount of some of the gifts and whether or not this was the type of influence that is proper in connection with office holders and persons in influence.
Rockefeller's explanation?
I know that every one of you has helped a friend in need. And I don't think there is a man or a woman in this country who would not have done the same. The American tradition has been to share, to help one's neighbor in time of trouble, to share one's blessings with friends and family.
Rockefeller also was asked about the financing of a book critical of his opponent in the 1970 New York gubernatorial campaign, former Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg.
In regard to the financing of the book on Mr. Justice Goldberg, let's face it, I made a mistake. I made a hasty, ill-considered decision in the middle of a hectic campaign in 1970. I've already apologized to Mr. Justice Goldberg, publicly and privately.
The Congressional Joint Committee on Internal Revenue Taxation estimated Rockefeller's net worth at $74 million, plus $33 million in potential trust income. Could this be the man who has so much money he doesn't know what to do with it? This is Tom Martin.